Hey everyone, a warm welcome in these cold and dark times. We're very glad to have you with us. I'm Henrik, and we are fast approaching the end of 2014 already. We hope that you're having a good Christmas, or Jul, as we say in Sweden, an important pre-Christian pagan tradition that at least I've learned to appreciate more and more each year, especially when you realize what it really means, and that is something that actually anchors us to the people who came before us. Lovely, lovely stuff. Well, whether you feel the same or not, I do hope you're ready for another radio program with some thoughts and opinions from two gentlemen at the alternative right. Colin Liddell and Andy Nowicki joins us today for a laid-back conversation in these hectic holiday times. I'm just tell you a little bit about our guests. Colin Liddell was born in Scotland, raised in South Africa, graduated from Greenwich University and Birkbeck, and is a longtime resident of Japan. He has served as editor of Tokyo Journal, Far East editor of the Erotic Review, and held several other positions both in journalism and education. Currently, he is the co-editor of Alternative Right, an online magazine of radical traditionalism. He also writes for Greg Johnson's Countercurrents, Kevin MacDonald's The Occidental Observer, and The Den. And then we have Andy Nowicki. He is a dissident, reactionary malcontent of modernity who lives in Savannah, Georgia in the States, and writes for fun and profit. In addition to writing and co-editing Alternative Right, he has contributed to Tacky Mag, Occidental Observer, Countercurrents, and The Last Ditch. Nowicki is the author of 8 published novels, including the controversial cult classic The Columbine Pilgrim and the time-tripping 80s nostalgia erotic murder mystery Heart Killer. Today we're going to talk about radical traditionalism, the left and the right, the alternative right, and a whole lot of other stuff in between. So stay with us as we get going. Well, hi guys, welcome to the program. Thank you to both of you for coming on. Great speaking with you today.
Thank you, Henrik. This is Andy. Very good to be on your broadcast.
Yeah, this is Colin. Yes, it's an honor to be on Red Ice, where so many other famous faces have express themselves.
Well, thank you, guys. I really appreciate that. It's great to have you here, and I'm really I'm really glad that we can talk a little bit more today about your website, Alternative Right. And of course, there's always the interesting aspect of talking how people came to some of these topics. So I think in some regards, some people's journalists have been kind of similar in terms of how they realized that the political environment that they grow up in and whatnot doesn't work anymore. We're trying to find other solutions and whatnot. So let's just kind of talk a little bit about that. And I guess we could begin with you, Andy. You happened to let me know prior to this show that you actually gone from the left pretty much over to the right, or the alternative right, should we say. So how did this, how was this path for you, Andy?
It's an interesting story, at least I think. Of course, it's my story, so of course it's interesting to me. I'll try to just hit the highlights here. I've always been, I mean, when I think about this question of how I came to be where I am today, holding the kind of views that I do that basically make me utterly contemptible to polite society, I think it over and wonder about it, and I realize one thing that steered me in this direction is, I suppose I've always been, I'm not a tough guy or anything like that. I don't claim to be, but I've always had a somewhat defiant and willful soul. And so when things are in the air and everybody's signaling, this is the way to be, this is the way to go, this, you know, if you don't believe these kinds of things, then you're stupid and get away from us. That really rubs me the wrong way. And so, I think back to my formative years. I was a teenager in America in the 80s, and the 80s were kind of a time of when conservatism, a kind of conservatism, let's say conservatism in quotes, was very hip. You know, you had Ronald Reagan, immensely popular. You know, won 2 landslide elections. You had Rambo. You had yuppies, and this whole idea that you're just sort of supposed to make a lot of money, and that's what it's all about. Alex P. Keaton on the show Family Ties, you know, everybody loved that guy, and this was it, for my teenager perception, this was very much in the air. This is what I'm supposed to be. And, you know, you don't want to be something other than this. And so, you know, with this kind of, quote, conservatism in the air, I, of course, became a communist. I was 15, 16 years of age, so I don't know how much I should really be held accountable for my actions. I was completely stupid, but it was a response. It was a reaction against, you know, a reaction of defiance against the culture that's out there. Now, I don't want to say that I didn't have any interest in truth, because hopefully I did, and hopefully I still do, and I think I do, and that it wasn't just some blind, you know, you believe that way, this way, I'll believe something different, you know, some blind anti-authoritarian thing. But I do think that's a part of it for me. So in the 80s, I was this left-wing, I mean, at one point I called myself a communist, carried around a copy of the Communist Manifesto at my, you know, high school, my suburban high school, redneck high school, just to try to get people's ire, you know, rouse people's ire and so forth. And it was, you know, really stupid and lame. But, I was 16, so... So then the late 80s came, in the early 90s, and I entered college. And before I became a freshman in college at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, I had no idea what political correctness was. I'd never heard of it. And the idea that there could be a kind of left-wing liberalism that was utterly intolerant and completely ubiquitous and just powerful beyond belief and just would crush anything in its wake, anything that dared to raise a peep, against it. That had never, I didn't know about that phenomenon. And then I entered college as a liberal and, you know, full of mostly left-wing ideas. Now, I mean, there were certain things that I was kind of I was a little bit ornery about, or I kind of had my own idiosyncratic point of view on. For instance, I was always very pro-religion. I was, you know, in one way or another, a Christian, and just sympathetic to religion and not sympathetic to the secularist point of view. And I always kind of had a certain moral conservatism with regard to the excesses of the sexual revolution. You know, I always kind of sensed that something was off and amiss about that. But in every other way, I was, you know, completely left wing. Then I entered college, where to be left wing was mandatory, and if you weren't, you know, totally politically correct, as they said back then, it's kind of a tiresome term, but you know, we know what it means. I mean, it's been used a lot.
Yep.
Today we say cultural Marxist, you know, same kind of thing.
Yep.
You know, and it wasn't just that the ubiquity of it. It was the fact that, you know, with some exceptions, I had a couple of classes. I was an English major. I loved literature. I still do. I wanted to read literature and talk about what it meant and get to the truth of things. But instead, everybody was, you know, all the hip, trendy ideologies were, you know, deconstructionism and feminism and colonial critique. And so you could never, it was like it was considered racist or something to talk about the text itself or talk about the meaning behind the text or look at it as, you know, the great books of the West kind of approach.
Right.
And that was immensely frustrating to me. And I also just hated the utter intolerance. Now, there are degrees of intolerance, of course. You know, there not everybody was just totally rabid, but the overall feel of things was that, you know, you better toe the line, and if you don't, you know, you're a bad, bad, bad person. You're a racist, sexist, homophobe, and so forth. And I also noticed that, you know, and this is where my interest in truth, I think, comes in, that there was this central contradiction to what I was being taught, because on the one hand, people were saying, the trendy thing was to say there is no truth, you know, everything just deconstructs, and you know, it's this kind of almost nihilistic approach to things, to literature and so forth. But then at the same time, you know, there's no truth, and yet you better be a feminist, and you better be anti-white colonialism, and you better be this, and you better be that. or else you're a bad person, and we're going to shame the hell out of you. You know, and it doesn't even make sense. You know, I was aware of this violently striking contradiction that I, you know, that just totally you know, frustrated me. And you know, it was as plain as day. It was as plain as the nose on your face. And yet all these supposedly smart people didn't seem to see it or didn't seem to want to talk about it. And so anyway, just to make it, I guess I'm getting a little too lengthy here, but by the time my college experience was over, I had, you know, fully forsworn my left liberalism and came out in the world as, I guess at first I kind of embraced a kind of libertarianism. Then I kind of, for a while, kind of flirted with just the mainstream conservatism. I listened to Rush Limbaugh a lot. I was never quite, you know, in that camp, but I was sympathetic enough to it to want to, you know, just want to see the Republicans win elections, just because I just really hated the left. And it was more of a thing of spite, spite against this completely hypocritical and intolerant group of people.
Right. Yeah.
And so, I guess right around the turn of the century, turn of the millennium, I started to look at things a little deeper and think, you know, well, is this conservatism really conservative? And, you know, if we're talking about being conservative, what is there to conserve? What is worth conserving?
Exactly.
And so, you know, maybe it's, so then I started to think of myself as more of a reactionary, and to look into these kind of ideologies that, you know, these kind of forbidden ideologies that, you know, that even conservatives in America, people who call themselves conservatives in America, you know, completely distanced from, you know, like these kind of pre-modern ideologies, looking at, you know, whether seeing, you know, being skeptical of democracy as a kind of mob rule, also being skeptical of egalitarianism and of feminism and you know, of the idea of that, that men and women are interchangeable, the idea that all the races, that we're all the same underneath our skin color, that whole ubiquitous notion, you know, everything was challengeable. Everything was up for review. And that's kind of where I still am at. You know, I'm just, you know, still in this state where I'm basically opposed to everything that had crossed my ideological path up to this point. And I find myself thrown in with a lot of other people like Colin and like others. And, you know, we don't necessarily see eye to eye on everything, but, and like you, Henrik, of course, you know, some of us may be Catholics. I'm a Roman Catholic. Mm-hmm. You know, I know, Colin is a pagan. And, so at Alternative Right, we kind of represent a broad spectrum, right then and there.
Which is good, of course. And something I want to talk a little bit more about later of right. How to kind of, you know, see eye to eye on certain issues despite right. having disagreements. But yeah, go ahead, Andy.
But yeah, but having this shared hatred of the zeitgeist, of the status quo, is really an incredibly galvanizing thing. And it really brings people together in a way that's kind of miraculous. Because we're aware we're up against a juggernaut and a ruthless juggernaut. And, you know, we better stick together and we better put aside whatever differences that we have right now, because, you know, this thing is trying to annihilate all of us. I maybe went on a little too long there, but that's my story. That's how I came to be the way.
Yeah,
I am.
No worries. That's great. And of course, there's a lot of interesting points that we can talk a little bit more about later. And of course, yes, it seems to be kind of more of a slow process to a certain extent, and just kind of having that innate rebellion against it. How about you, Colin? Did you have a similar path? How did you come into these topics?
Well, how did I become a common sense, middle of the road moderate? Yeah, that's a very interesting
right.
complex question. Yeah, I think once you're thrown into this world, all sorts of forces work upon you, and you know, to push you this way and that way. I guess part of my early experience of growing up in South Africa probably played an important role in sort of laying the foundations for a degree of kind of racial realism. But that wasn't really a major factor in my consciousness at the time, but that only became apparent later. But then I also grew up in Thatcher's Britain. So I was one of Thatcher's children. So in those days, we were living in Scotland, and there was very, very high unemployment. And there was lots of kind of social dysfunction. And I used to kind of contrast the very orderly and well-disciplined primary school I went to in South Africa with the rather chaotic and dysfunctional socialist-inspired comprehensive school I went to in Scotland. And so looking at that contrast also made me more probably common sense and middle-of-the-road moderate.
Explain what you mean by that, Colin, because I think, you know, how are you spinning yourself as a moderate when most people would see you as a far right extremist?
Yeah, exactly. I was wondering that too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, this happens all the time. I mean, you know, if you believe in very, very kind of simple, obvious things like traditional gender roles, you're some sort of nutcase according to a certain liberal narrative. If you're against the genocide through mass immigration and low birth rates of your race and your country, then you're obviously some kind of some kind of nutcase out of the madhouse, you know, according to those same narratives. So I actually refuse to accept that I'm in any way a so-called extremist. I mean, I think there is a place for extremism in creating new ideas, because new ideas always tend to come from the extremes of society, but there is a kind of filtering process by which these ideas are checked and vetted, and then if they make sense, they become they eventually become mainstream and moderate ideas. A lot of these ideas that have been foisted upon us from the extreme left have not really been properly vetted and tested by society in any meaningful way. And so that's why we have these really ridiculously unnatural things happening today. So, you know, first of all, I think to actually accept the idea that you're an extremist is disempowering in several ways. So I don't really accept that I'm an extremist. I think my ideas are all quite commonsensical and natural ideas. So, you know.
So it's the spectrum that has moved, not you. Right, the political spectrum is more to the left, right?
Yes, it's through various accidents of history and economics, along with the willing participation of certain powerful groups, things have been pushed in that direction. But most people are still more or less where I am.
Yeah,
and you know, the purposes of the alternative right and our movement in general is to try to make people realize that. So it's not like we're preaching to some tiny embittered minority that will never amount to anything. You know, we're actually representing the heart and soul of our people.
Right, exactly. Now, maybe we can just talk a little bit about if there's any differences with, let's say, the new right. There's a lot of, you know, new things popping up on the political end of things, and they're beginning to formulate now and whatnot, and there's sometimes is, you know, massive disagreements, of course, sometimes it's just very much similarities and whatnot. But is the alternative right something that's radically different for people who don't know about the website or the work that you guys do?
I'll try to handle that. First I'll come up with my best guess and then let Colin give what probably will be a better answer. The term alternative right was not invented by either one of us, but I think it's a very useful term in that it's as a brand, it's something that conjures to mind, yes, we are the right, but we're to be distinguished from what you commonly think of as the right, maybe in certain ways and in certain cases. And I think it's, you know, it's kind of the other side of the coin of what Colin was talking about. You know, Colin says, you know, I'm a moderate. I reject the idea of being an extremist, and I think there's something to be said for that. I've talked before. I was having a conversation the other day about how in certain ways I don't feel like, you know, I talked about how I was a left winger in the 80s and how I'm a right winger now. In some ways I haven't really changed, but it's like, you know, I've stayed rooted with certain principles, and it's like the tide has changed. Back then the tide was coming in, now the tide is going out.
Yeah.
But I've stayed exactly where I am in a lot of ways. And, you know, as far as the being titled an extremist, I mean, it's kind of a semantic issue in some ways.
Andy.
Yes. Yes.
Probably the most extreme thing about you is your intense anti-sexualism.
well, yeah, we don't need to necessarily get into that right now, but yes, I have. I don't know. I don't embrace the term anti-sexualist. That's a little quite extreme sounding, but I am very, I do have a very strong, I mean, I spoke earlier about how, you know, I had a thing even in the 80s. My impression was that the sexual revolution had really caused a terrible lot of damage to Western society. And I still think that, and I still, you know, it's in some ways the most radical stance that a person can take today is to take a stance against sexual hedonism and, you know, and for, you know, in favor of restraint. And that's a big part of, I think that's maybe my shtick in some ways. It's certain things that I like to reflect on. But anyway, just turning back to the whole extremist versus moderate thing, it's kind of a question of semantics in certain ways, because, you know, Barry Goldwater, I actually like this quote, you know, that maybe you both know already, that he said when someone accused him of being extremist, he said, "Extremism in the pursuit of liberty is no vice." I would put in a different word for liberty there. I would say maybe in the pursuit of truth. But, you know, I'm not afraid of being called an extremist. And I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's a scare word. It's something, there's something to be said for just embracing it and saying, yeah, just like Barry did, you know, saying, yeah, I'm an extremist and I'm okay with that.
Owning it, you know, saying, so what?
Whatever, owning it, yeah. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, Colin, did you have anything else in terms of, I guess, how the alternative right differs from some of the other ideologies out there at the moment?
It differs in a lot of ways. I mean, there is this, one of the big problems with the present age is that we have this problem of egalitarianism. And that seems to be the foundation of so many things and ideas and political parties, and almost everybody kind of seems to sign up on that. And of course, one of the things about the alternative right and the new right is we don't actually believe in egalitarianism, and the reasons for that are actually very simple, because, you know, equality does not really exist in nature. So it's better to have an ideology that reflects reality and nature than one that is a kind of abstract imposition on all of being and creation, you see. So I think that's probably the most important difference is that we just reject the idea of egalitarianism. And of course, when you start from that premise, then that kind of feeds into other things. So that means you have a different view of gender. You see women and men not as the same. I mean, they are different. And so that there is a kind of inequality implicit in that. Yeah. And then, of course, there's this sort of racial differences. And that is dependent on what standard you wish to use, whether, you know, you're into baseball statistics or how many Nobel Prizes have been won, then that creates inequality too. So there are all these various forms of inequality. And if we just recognize that and designed our societies around that, then we'd save ourselves a lot of trouble.
Oh, yeah.
But I would say, you know, if we're talking about maybe what a foundational stance, something that we would all of us at Alternative Right would agree with. And I think that probably most of us would be on board to some degree or another with the you know, the anti-egalitarian stance. I certainly would. But I also want to just underline a point I was making earlier, which is that I think at our website, we talk about a movement, quote unquote, and I guess it is a movement in a way, but it's also a ragtag movement made, composed of several different kinds of perspectives. And, you know, like I said, we talked about the Christian pagan differences, and, you know, some people have, certain perspectives that are anathema to the liberal left cultural Marxist culture, you know, with regard to race or with regard to gender or something else. But I think what we all share in common, again, I want to sort of underscore this, is a shared opposition to this terrifying juggernaut that is, you know, that we face, that is incredibly powerful. The same people that I first, you know, the same force that I came, you know, that my eyeballs met when I entered college, and I saw these are the opinion shapers. And, you know, there's so much just utter ubiquity of opinion about yeah, this and that and the other thing. And you can't disagree with them or else you're, you know, you're evil. Yeah. And, you know, and we're going to ostracize you.
Andy, yes. Once you start talking about that kind of juggernaut, then you're creating a kind of Rorschach blotch moment, aren't you? Because different people are going to imagine different things from that. Some people are going to imagine this international Jewish conspiracy as usual. Other people are going to imagine the Brahmin class, or, you know, so there are these different things that spring into people's minds when you use that kind of language.
Yeah. Right. Are you guys...
Who is the juggernaut?
Right, yeah. Do you want to address that, Andy? Any thoughts?
Well, who do I think it is? I don't have any. It's not a code word for anything in the way that I use it.
Sure.
I'm talking about the prevalent ideology of our times, and I think it's a, you know, a debased ideology that's deeply erroneous and tyrannical, and I hate it with every fiber of my being.
Do you think it's just it's just post-Christianity or spiritual vacuum or materialism? What do you actually think it is, though?
Well, I don't think we're going to get to the bottom of this question, you know, in this discussion tonight. It's probably all of those things in one degree or another, and it may even be the you-know-whos. I don't know. those we must not name to some degree or other.
Right.
I mean, I know that's what everybody thinks that, you know, I'm speaking in code about when I talk about the juggernaut, or what some people think, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, Henrik, do you have a take on this issue?
Well, I certainly do, you know, and it's, I guess to a certain extent, you're right there in terms of, you know, how deep you can go into this and how much we're going to be able to cover about that on just, in the time we have here today. But yeah, I want to hear a little bit more about, you know, what you guys have to say about the, I mean, Colin, if you said before, this is kind of like a laboratory, really, right? It's something which are ideas that are not being tested. It's like these things are happening to us. And it seems to me that the establishment then, let's call them that for now, has rejected, they have rejected science, they have rejected biology and reality, really, ultimately. So obviously the question to follow up, instead of, like, I guess, avoiding the who, I guess we can talk a little bit more about the why. Is this, do you think, Colin, just something that is experimented upon us, or is it a very distinct, directed kind of path that we're taking here by the political class, the establishment, if you will?
Yeah, I think the kind of key concept in this case is humanism. And by that, I mean the ability to be human, and that is to actually define who you are as a person and as a group. And in other words, to be a kind of subject of history, and, you know, so to sort of have a vision, to follow that vision. Like, for example, you might have a nationalist vision. You might believe in your nation, and so therefore you create your nation, and your nation has a sense of itself, and it has a role that it plays, and it kind of makes that decision, and it's not sort of determined by others. Or other forces, and what I think is happening is that there's a kind of diminishment of humanism in that sense. I think we've become kind of objects of forces, and so we're sort of acted upon by the forces of modernity. And so that that reduces our ability to actually control things and to be a subject in history. And so we become, you know, homo economicus. So we're sort of always chasing materialism, economic growth. Yeah. This becomes the standard by which political parties justify themselves to the voters. We will give you more economic growth. There will be more shopping centers. There will be more shopping malls, etc. And I think that just represents a kind of loss of our will and a loss of our subjectivity. And a lot of people do sort of see this as part of some great global conspiracy. But, you know, I think it's just a general loss of control, which has been caused by the sort of vast economic takeoff that's happened in the last, 200 or so years, you know, because since we've broken free of the Malthusian trap. And so you've had this kind of exponential economic growth and all these economic relations developing all around the world. And so people have just become kind of addicted to all the various possibilities that this has opened up. And they're no longer defining themselves. They're sort of being defined by fashions and tastes and desires. And so they're sort of gravitating very quickly towards their id side rather than their kind of ego side.
Mm-hmm. Right. Andy?
I mean, it's an interesting question. It's something that I don't have I go back and forth on. You know, I was thinking the other day, I was thinking just now, actually, as Colin was talking, but I'm blanking on his name. Who's the reptilian guy that you had him on?
David Icke, yeah.
Yeah, David Icke.
Yeah.
I mean, these kinds of theories of there being some real malevolent force behind it all, and I guess you can get theological with that, you know, in some ways. The reptil is there, you know, the reptilian equals Satan, you know, whatever. I guess it's an open question to me, because there are, in my view, you know, from what I've, I'm a connoisseur of quote conspiracy theories. And when I say conspiracy theories, I'm not putting them down or belittling them. I'm just trying to sort of categorize them in a particular way.
Right.
they interest me because there's probably more going on than we know of than what meets the eye. And there's probably some really wicked and nefarious, powerful people doing some terrible things that we don't really have a clue about. And maybe there are reptilians or something like that behind it all. But in another way, another interesting way of looking at it is, you know, maybe the rulers themselves, the people who, these evil people who want to rule and enslave the rest of us, essentially, in one way or another, maybe in a way they too are enslaved, in the sense that, you know, the kind of thing that comes to mind when we see, you know, at Nelson Mandela's funeral, I don't know if you guys remember this, you saw President Obama and the Danish Prime Minister and some other people, and they were snapping, you know, selfies of themselves. And it was just, I mean, these are the rulers of the world, and they're acting like, you know, giggling little teenage girls. I mean, it was, when I see things like that, I kind of wonder, you know, who is behind it all? These people who, you know, here they are, and this is what they're doing. This is how they're behaving. You know, how much power can they really have, over us, in the sense of how much self-control do they really have? And you can only have power if you have self-control. And when you're just at the, you know, when you're at the whim of, whatever is out there, whatever, you know, whether it's your desires for more power or, you know, for sex or whatever it is, that's a loss of control. And so maybe, you know, maybe this tyranny and chaos kind of go hand in hand.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of sounding like I'm taking a hit off a bong and saying something that I think is really profound.
But, but I see what you're saying. And I mean, obviously, I think more or less everyone feels that way when we see, you know, the absurdity of our world leaders, and then we see the direction right. of the world, which seems so much more nefarious, and you have to wonder. I mean, I come from that environment, if you will, of conspiracy and searching the truth and being inherently right. suspicious of what's going on. So I get what sure. you're saying, for sure, yeah.
Right.
I tend to believe in a certain kind of blind coherence. So you do have certain groups who act together, but it's not necessarily done in a very conscious way. It's rather similar to the way that you see certain groups of animals behaving in the wild. Like you have these flocks of birds, and they all magically move together in the right way. And in the ocean, you see schools of fish swimming together, and they all manage to have a general coherence and coordination. But then you wouldn't say they're actually conscious of their position and what they're doing. And so you see these kinds of swarm mm-hmm. behaviors, you know. So I think that seems to be the pattern of a lot of the things that are happening.
Yeah, well, I think nonetheless, I guess if we think about it, if it's consciously directed or not, I personally, I think the main program anyway is consciously driven, and then of course you have a lot of I guess we can call them useful yeah, idiots along the way that are doing all these things.
Henry, once you say that, you have to then define who the group is and what they want and the stages that they've actually achieved to achieve their goals.
Well, it's kind of a work in progress still. That's why we do the website. You know?
I mean,
I know what you're saying.
That if we talk about something like Zionism, which is probably ideal for this kind of case study.
Sure, yeah.
The creation of the state of Israel, that would be an obvious goal that Zionists would have.
Yeah.
But when you look at the actual process by which the state of Israel was created, there were actually a lot of very accidental factors. For example, Turkey coming into the war on the side of Germany, Germany then losing that war, all those things that could have gone wrong. So, you know, the state of Israel depends for its existence upon a lot of chance occurrences.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I guess in that particular topic area, I think they have a lot of different plans though, right? They have Argentina, they had the Jewish Oblast in Russia, and there was a lot of different contenders, I guess, on the plate at that time before they decided to pick the Middle East, right? So
Yeah. I mean, well, obviously, the Middle East would have been the first choice, but in a funny way, even that doesn't really make sense, because a lot of these early Zionists, they were actually very non-religious people. So right. Why would a non-religious
most of them still are? I think the ones who call themselves Zionists are generally secular Jews.
Right.
Yeah. So why would secular Jews have this need to specifically locate their state in the traditional religious center of ancient Judea? That, you know, that so there's a certain illogicality in that. And the Zionist movement was also quite a small movement at first, and it sort of came into being as the possibility opened up. But it would be sort of a bit absurd to see that as a kind of perfectly coordinated set of series of events that they controlled and manipulated, leading to the creation of the state of Israel. So I think we have to, in any rational person, would have to admit that there's a very large accidental element in the creation of that state. So I think certain groups do behave in certain ways. They do have certain interests, and it's obvious that in the case of America, Jews have a very obvious interest in creating a much more multicultural society. That obviously works to their benefit. And so you can see how they've put a lot of their resources, financial and cultural and academic, into creating certain policies which have led to the increase in multiculturalization of America, with the increase in and future marginalization of whites. So there are ways to see that, but you know you have to be careful how far you go. I think certain narratives like anti-Semitism or anti-Zionism or the all-powerful, all-orchestrating Jew, those kinds of theories are very kind of seductive to a lot of people who are unhappy with the direction the modern world is taking, and who feel personally disempowered, and who want this kind of simplistic reductionist and bugbear that they can beat against.
See, the Jewish question always draws a lot of attention, of course, when you talk in any kind of skeptical way about the claims of certain anti-Semites, and I'm not using the word anti-Semite necessarily in a negative way. I'm just in a descriptive way, where that almost immediately draws hoots and hollers and boos and catcalls from people that you think that you're a sellout I've been accused of being a Jew myself a few times before, but if I were I wouldn't think that would be relevant, but it was anyway the
it's just foreign name.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
But what does the wiki mean?
But it's sort of something where, since we're on the topic of the Jews, we were talking before. It's sort of like, I think that the best way to go with this topic and with so many other topics is, okay, don't kiss their asses, right? On the one hand, they're not behind every bad thing, every evil thing in the world. There's some good ones and there's some bad ones. They are a very powerful group. Yes, and it's okay and it's perfectly appropriate to draw attention to talk about the Jewish power and what it means and what its impact is, and so forth. But to say that, okay, there's a point beyond which Jewish power does not go, but still, even though just because I'm not saying the Jews aren't all powerful doesn't mean I'm kissing the Jews' asses any more than, if I said to somebody, who was extremely racist against blacks, let's say, and violently hateful against blacks, if I said, well, you're right about this or that, and of course the liberal narrative, if you will, is that blacks are inherently wonderful, or gays, a more recent sort of newly minted sainted group where, gays and lesbians are never supposed to criticize for anything. And of course, they're always wonderful people. Whenever a gay character appears on a TV show, he's a good guy or a good girl. That can't be any moral ambiguity because he's homosexual. So he must be great. Must be wonderful.
Right. Yeah.
But there's a way of challenging that whole, kiss the Jews' ass, kiss the blacks' ass, kiss the gays' ass. There's a way of challenging that, and that gets us into some territory maybe we don't want to talk about, that last thing. But
there's a way of
there's a way of challenging that without going the other extreme and just saying, keeping it in perspective. But I think that the essential thing is you just don't, the powers that be want you to kiss up to certain groups. If you show that you do not kiss up to group X, sainted group X, like blacks rioting in Ferguson, if you say these are a bunch of thugs, and I don't even care if you think I'm racist for saying that, then of course they're going to think they're going to think the worst possible things about you and think that you hate all black people on sight, and that's okay. I mean that's just what they've been trained to believe, but it's like sort of finding a middle ground, I guess, is sort of the rather boring way I'll end on, because you don't want to be a monomaniac and say and just go down the rabbit hole and say anything about group X, but on the other hand you want to avoid the error that we're trained to think that of course whites are just bad, and Jews are wonderful, blacks are wonderful, Hispanics are wonderful, gays and lesbians are wonderful, right?
Right.
There's a middle ground. There's reality,
Right. Yes.
That also leads to its kind of mirror opposite that, Jews are evil, blacks are evil, gays are evil. So, you get this very kind of polarized, very stupidly polarized viewpoint.
Right. I always think to myself that maybe there's going to be a time when suddenly everything is going to flip and all of the prejudices that we're supposed to have now, we're going to, you know, it's going to flip and we're going to all be expected to kiss the asses of the people that we're supposed to hate now and vice versa. And I just think around that time, you know, I'll have to just become a liberal again, you know, if that happens, because I mean, it's all about balance. It's about challenging where
Andy,
the power is.
You just like being bullied, Andy, I think.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's it. I'm a masochist.
Well, so I guess to a certain extent, what you're saying here a little bit is kind of you feel that there shouldn't be a singling out for the purpose of making anybody more special than they really are. If they are better at fulfilling their, let's say, tribal aspirations or not, okay, so that might be the issue here. But it's more about what we do than as opposed to what they do, right? It's more about how do we change the tide that is happening towards us as opposed to focusing on what everyone else is doing. Is that a fair approach, Andy?
Yeah, I could buy that, sure.
Because sounds good. Because some things here, obviously, I wanted to get into that a little bit too. We can see if we can touch on that maybe a little bit here, and then we're going to take a break in a while and talk more in the second here. But I wanted to get closer into the importance of different things around us that we, basically how we can see things have been hijacked. I've talked many times about the importance of, you know, culture and storytelling and taking back the ability of you know, making movies, for example, or TV shows, or not the least, writing novels and all these things. This is something, it's kind of an art, the importance of art. That's something that we've lost, I feel, and something that we've kind of given up and handed over to other people, right?
Yes, and I guess we'll be getting into that in a little bit. Of course, that's another one of my, another part of my shtick is something that I promote, something I believe in very strongly. I mean, when I call it my shtick, I guess that sort of makes it sound like it's just a, you know, not an important thing, but it is an important thing in my mind. And that is the arts. That is building up the arts for, you know, for the dissidents in our culture, whatever we want to call ourselves, whether you're a white nationalist or a pre-modernist or I don't know, whatever else, however you categorize yourself, you're opposed to the dominant culture. It's not enough, I think, to simply, there's a certain comfort zone that we can get into with talking about certain red meat kind of topics. And for the last few weeks, that red meat has been Ferguson, Missouri.
Yeah.
What's been going on there, with the Michael Brown case and then the riots and other things, somebody like Lena Dunham. I don't know whether you're familiar with.
Unfortunately, I am. Yes.
Yeah, it's another
girls. Oh my God.
Another baleful influence from the United States of America on the rest of the world.
Yeah.
You know, people. Well, cases like them, like Lena Dunham or like Ferguson, draw us into our echo chamber, and we say certain things, and you know, sort of get outraged and, you know, say things to as Colin was saying before the show, this idea that we signal certain things that, you know, to show that we're on the same side. And ultimately I find it kind of tiresome. And we've got to, at some point, you know, achieve a kind of meta dialogue, let's say, or something that goes beyond a meta politics, something that goes beyond just addressing the issues of the day and the things that really bug us about the latest Hollywood liberal and, you know, or black crime or mass immigration. Not to say that any of these issues aren't, you know, worthy of discussion, but there's, you know, and I think that's the arts, novels, as you say, Henrik, movies, although movies are much, you know, more difficult proposition because you've got to have
a lot of fun.
Got to have some De Niro to make even a cheap movie.
Yep.
But yeah. So that's something I guess you know, we can talk more about later.
Yeah, let's kind of get into the meat of that, the art aspect, and talk with both of you guys of, you know, how you view that and whatnot. But I wanted to spend a little bit of time of talking about you guys' writing, and of course we want to give out the website details and all that. But I guess Colin, we could begin with you a little bit. I've been enjoying a lot of your articles, and of course you write over at the Occidental Observer, I know, and of course at the alternative right, the website and all that. But you also have
Countercurrents and also Theeden.
Yes, that's right. And you have a couple of books out there as well. Tell us about those.
Well, they're not actually my books. I mean, I've written part of the book. I mean, I've got a chapter, or in one case, a poem in those books. But I don't actually have my own book of my own writings. So that might come sometime in the future. Who knows?
All right, very good. Is there any other websites you'd like to give out where people can follow your work and read more?
Well, there's Alternative Right, Countercurrents, Occidental Observer, and Theeden. Those are the main ones at the moment for my various political writings.
And TalkieMag, right? Don't you have stuff at TalkieMag?
Yeah, but I haven't had anything published at TalkieMag for a long time, so I don't really count that. The books you're referring to, one of the books is the Aristocratia, which is a kind of compendium of various writings by a lot of people from the alternative right or the traditionalist movement. And I'm in Aristocratia Volume 2 and also Aristocratia Volume 3, which is coming out, I think, early next year. So that's well worth getting. There's a lot of other very interesting writers in there, probably more interested than me. So check it out. And if you're interested in my poetry, I'm included in a collection called Melpomene. And you can find both books at the Alternative Right website in the sidebar.
All right, very good. We're, of course, going to have the links up to this as well, alternative-right.blogspot.com. And Andy, let's talk about your work as well. You have, I think, 7 books out there now, the Columbine Pilgrim being one of these. Tell us more about your books.
Yes, I have several novels that I've published. Famous would be the right word, but the one that sold the most copies would be The Columbine Pilgrim, and that's published through Countercurrents, Greg Johnson's company. Greg, I'm very thankful to Greg for giving me this shot and enabling me to be published. He actually, my first novel is a book called Considering Suicide. I'll just go chronologically. I have a book called Considering Suicide, which sort of considers the whole to be or not to be thing. And of course, Hamlet's, I guess, sort of akin to you, Henrik, right? In a way, Sweden, Denmark,
right.
Same neck of the woods. that was my first novel, Considering Suicide, and that's published by a company called Nine Banded Books. Chip Smith is the publisher, and I'm very thankful to him as well. And then I've got 3 books that I've published through Countercurrents. Again, The Columbine Pilgrim, which is a work of horror fiction, considering one man's obsession with the school shooting at Columbine, and I won't give any more details than that right now, but that's interesting to anyone in the audience. They should maybe check it out. And I've also got a book called Under the Nile, which is Nile is spelled N-I-H-I-L, which is like Nihil, but it's meant to be a pun for Nile, like the River Nile.
Yep.
And that's actually a book that's being translated right now into Portuguese, and it's going to be released in Brazil, which is, I know, sounds kind of random, but I'm very happy. I'm very pleased with that. So I've got Columbine Pilgrim, Under the Nile. I've also got a book called Lost Violent Souls through Countercurrents, which is a collection of short stories. And a big influence for me is Dostoevsky, somebody that really influences my writing style. So those are the 3 I've got through Countercurrents. And then I've also got a book called The Doctor and the Heretic. And this was originally published by a company that's now not now defunct, but it's got a second edition through Hopeless Books, Ann Sturzinger's edgy little indie company. I've also got a book called a novella called Beauty and the Least, about one man's terrifying obsession with a young girl and where it leads. And let's see, I'm leaving something out here. And Heart Killer, which was originally published by ER Books and is still available from ER Books on Kindle in an electronic format.
Andy, what does ER stand for?
I'm not going to answer that question, but
all right.
People can find out for themselves. But it was recently published also in print form from Hopeless Books, so it's available in print and in electronic form. And Heart Killer is maybe my favorite of my books. It's a time tripping murder mystery, it's got a couple of interesting intertwining narratives. I'm sort of just rambling right now, but I hope that if anything, any of these books that I mentioned, if they stand out to anybody as potentially interesting, and also if you like Dostoevsky, if you like edgy dark fiction, that's really kind of what I'm into. And I've also, my newest book is a very oddly titled book called Confessions of a Would-Be Wanker, which you can find out more. I don't want to get too into the whole thesis of that book and what it's all about, but you can find out more at the Alternative Right website. I've got some excerpts from it, which details it in a little greater gives a little bit more information about it. But it's sort of a continuation of my critique of the over-sexualized age in which we live.
I think that's a valid critique for sure. Now, do you have a page where you have all the titles listed, Andy?
Well, I do have a website, andynowicki.blogspot.com, and I also have a SoundCloud page where I've read certain excerpts from my stories, and you can find that page at the Alternative Right site, but it's JNOW1101 at SoundCloud.com. And I enjoy reading. I enjoy presenting. I was an actor in a previous life, and so I kind of still have this brazen theatricality that maybe appeals more to some people than to others. But anyway, I felt moved to give some audio excerpts of some of my work. And so if you're interested, you can find it there.
All right, great. Well, sounds good. We'll have the links up on our website as well, folks, so you can click through easily from our pages there to the guys' different works and all that. But okay, we'll take a short break here, guys. We have much more to discuss, of course. We're just kind of getting into it here, really. But stay with us, and we'll pick this up right after a short break.
Reconnecting.